Hi, my name is Amanda Hale, and this is my fifth podcast in the Mad Hatter series. This podcast is about cognitive dissonance and the psychology of Christopher Brooke, who is the central character in my latest novel, Mad Hatter, and a fictionalized version of my own father. Christopher Brooke is an extremely social man, always in company, at the Hat Factory, where he works in an executive position, on the tennis court and the cricket pitch, with his family, playing with the children, or out with his wife, socializing with the Cheshire set. He is leader of the Stockport branch of the British Union of Fascists, attending meetings, rallies, and membership drives. When war is declared and Christopher is arrested and placed in solitary confinement, a slow disintegration of his social personality begins. During a 3-year internment, he is thrown back on his own resources, which are minimal after a lifetime of herd activity from boarding school onwards, always part of a team, a family, a workforce. It becomes clear in the narrative arc of Christopher's disintegration that he perhaps never had the chance to develop the strong psychological and emotional resources that sustain a person through life's most extreme challenges, challenges that are accentuated in times of war. As a poignant counterpoint to Christopher's internment and disintegration, we hear of his wife's Parisian friend, Mireille Place, who was part of the resistance and was captured by the Nazis and tortured before being sent to Auschwitz-Birkenau. After the liberation, Christopher Brooke's wife, Cynthia, receives a letter from Mireille's parents saying that she did not break under torture and was brave until the end, when she died on a death march towards the end of the war. Christopher is based on the character of my own father, who was interned for 3 years during World War II because he was a member of Oswald Mosley's British Union of Fascists, and as such was considered a potential threat to national security once war was declared. I recognized in my father during the writing of Mad Hatter a condition called cognitive dissonance. It is, in fact, a humorous condition to write about. I would find myself laughing while reading to friends from the manuscript, scenes that described perfectly the tragicomic gap between reality and behavior. I felt guilty to be laughing at what was, in effect, an ever-widening gap between my father's sense of reality and the true reality surrounding him. Cognitive dissonance is a psychological condition defined as having inconsistent thoughts, beliefs, or attitudes, especially relating to behavioral decisions. Amazingly, one is able to function quite successfully in the world in a state of cognitive dissonance, so long as the condition does not endanger or offend others. In Christopher's case, it makes him appear a fool, a clown, and in some instances it obviously enraged Britons, who had moved from a pre-war desire for appeasement to a deeply patriotic stance when war was declared. He is beaten up in Mrs. Plumley's cafe when he attempts to engage a group of young men on the topic of pacifism. While living in Southport after the war, after the breakup of his marriage, he is working as a casual day labourer and is once again attacked by his fellow men for his proselytising. Cliff Bird simply avoids Christopher, embarrassed when his former friend greets him on the street with "Heil Hitler." The response to the same declamation in church at a harvest festival service right after the war is one of shock and outrage from the congregation. Here's a short reading from that particular scene. At 9:30 next morning, Christopher took Charlotte and Jimmy by the hand and walked them down the road to Woodford Church. The interior was decorated with sheaves of wheat and bunches of golden chrysanthemums, giant pumpkins, baskets of red apples and yellow corn cobs. There was an uneasy shuffling amongst the congregation as Christopher and the children took their places next to the Brooks in the front pew. It was like the rustling of leaves before a storm. As the vicar entered, he took the measure of things, nodding almost imperceptibly in the direction of the Brooke family. Then the service began, with hymns and prayers that required much kneeling and rising, sitting and standing, flipping of pages in prayer books, and searching for hymns. So much to keep everyone occupied that they forgot the traitor in their midst. When it was time for the sermon, the vicar ascended the steps to the pulpit and stood there, hands looped into the folds of his cassock, his face solemn as he began with a blessing for the soldiers who had fought and died in Europe and in North Africa. He named each of his parishioners' sons who had fallen in the line of duty, and each who was still fighting. "Let us give thanks for the bravery of our sons in the Allied invasion of Sicily," he said, his eyes ablaze, "and for the overthrow of the Italian fascist Mussolini, which has enabled our Italian brothers to become our allies." Jimmy grew fidgety, and Charlotte whispered to him to keep still. But Christopher was riveted, his steely eyes focused on the vicar. Suddenly he rose to his feet and called out, his voice resounding through the chilly church, "Hypocrite! None will be revealed as guiltier than the clergy for the misfortunes that have been brought upon the world. You profess adherence to the teachings of Jesus Christ, and yet you promote war and hatred with your every utterance." There was shocked silence. Old Mr. Brooke dropped his head into his hands, and his wife went rigid, a nervous smile twitching at the corners of her mouth. Nobody moved. Then suddenly they came to life in a rising cacophony of outraged voices, turning to each other for comfort, shocked parishioners assaulted in the haven of their own church. But Christopher's voice rang out relentlessly above them all as he raised his right arm in a salute, declaiming, "Heil Hitler!" Jimmy stared up at his father and pulled anxiously on his trouser leg. "Love thy neighbour as thyself!" Christopher's voice rang out. "It takes two to make a fight, and the Christian role is the pacifist one." He continued above a second wave of protest, and despite his own mother tugging at his sleeve, "You clerics have loved neither God nor your neighbours. You have merely served to assist in the maintenance of the Mammon system as supporters of successive governments that have honoured gold rather than God." His right arm flailed while his left rested on his son's narrow shoulders in response to Jimmy's persistent tugging. "If Christian peace had been won for Europe in 1918, there would have been neither opportunity nor need for a Hitler to redress the wrongs of mankind by force. Blind even to the words of their prophets in the Bible, the churches have consistently courted the disasters foretold for the judgment of a world that has denied Christ."
"Daddy! Daddy!" Charlotte was pulling at her father's hand. "Jimmy has to go wee-wee now!"
Christopher was suspended a moment in the now hushed church. Then he bent down and picked the boy up in his arms and edged his way out of the pew. Everyone stared in hostile silence as he walked down the aisle with his children, urine already seeping through Jimmy's trousers, and Charlotte smirking shamefaced with sidelong glances at the staring congregation. When they reached the heavy oaken door, Christopher turned as though he would deliver a final homily. But then he was gone, the door sending a cold draught through the congregation as it closed. Earlier in the novel, we hear Christopher inviting Mary Byrne, the Irish housekeeper, to accompany him to church, to speak out against the hypocrisy of the clergy. Their conversation in the kitchen over morning tea is a perfect example of the tragicomic gap of Christopher's cognitive dissonance. I'll read you the scene between Mary Byrne and Christopher. "When I came down next morning to start the fires, I got the shock of my life, for he was sitting at the kitchen table like a ghost with his head in his hands. 'Oh, Mr. Brooke,' I said, 'you gave me such a start. What are you doing up so early, sir, and on a Sunday? Would you like a cup of tea? I'll get the fire going and put the kettle on to boil.' He was miles away again, I could tell, because he looked up as though he was seeing right through me. What a pair we were, me blabbing away and him off with the fairies. But he came to then, and he stood up and smiled, a most charming smile, and I was undone. 'Let me help you, Mary,' he said. And he came forward and put his hand on my shoulder, which, even though it was there only seconds, set up such a turmoil in me, I did not trust myself to speak again. He got down on one knee, took the poker, and began rattling out the cold ashes into the pan under the grate. 'Is there a bucket?' he asked, looking up at me with his clear blue eyes. I hurried out to the scullery and fetched the bucket from the back corridor where the washing machine lived, and I was in such haste I almost tripped on the door sill as I came back into the kitchen. He was waiting for me with a shovel full of ashes, which he tipped into my bucket, causing a cloud of ash to rise around us and settle on our clothing.
"Let me do it, sir," I said. "It's no work for a gentleman."
"I must make myself useful, Mary. My life depends on it."
When we'd finished laying the fire, he set it alight, and it gave him great satisfaction, I could see, to watch the flames leap around the kindling, consuming the newspaper, licking at the black coals with little sparks and explosions as it burned up the coal dust. The kettle was soon bubbling, and I ran to the scullery and made a pot of strong tea. When I returned with the tray, he was standing with his back to me, staring out the window, perhaps looking across the field to the pond and the woods beyond, thinking about disappearing. That was the feeling of Christopher Brooke, a missing person, a fugitive you can't get a hold of. No wonder Cynthia was driven mad. He was a wraith, like one of the fairy people that dwelt in the fields and in the woods. My da had warned me about them when I was little.
"They will steal you away to ward off their own death, Mary," he'd say.
The master turned then and looked at me strangely, as though he had forgotten I was there and felt intruded upon. "Will you take a cup of tea, sir?" I asked, and a smile of recognition lit up his face as he sat at the big square table with me and waited while I poured. "Is it too early for the mistress?"
"Oh, yes, we mustn't disturb her yet."
He stirred 2 heaping teaspoons of sugar into his cup, lifted it to his lips and sipped. Then he replaced his cup firmly in the saucer and turned to me. I thought he might confide in me about their disagreement the previous night, but no, all his concerns were for the impersonal.
"Mary, I must tell you that I stand for peace and socialism. That is why I have been detained, uncharged and untried. Do you stand for socialism?"
"Oh, sir, where I come from, we are for a united Ireland and a good square meal on the table each day."
"Of course, your life is a hand-to-mouth existence, so to speak."
"Indeed, sir, or why else would I be here far from my home and my family?"
"We have much in common, Mary. I've come to understand this kind of life in a very personal manner since my detainment."
He stared intently at me with his sharp blue eyes, the pupils small and black like those of a bird. There was a world behind that blueness. It was like looking into the sky.
"But how can we level the playing field and attain true socialist values?"
"I don't know, sir. I only know that it is important to care for the children and bring them up to feel loved."
"My children are indeed blessed in having you as their nanny."
"I am not a nanny, sir. I was taken on by the mistress as housekeeper." I took a gulp of tea and almost choked. I was so embarrassed at speaking out of turn, but he carried on unruffled. It was impossible to offend him, as I learned later. He was a man so removed as to be entirely protected from a feeling of hurt.
"And what of your religious convictions? Are you Catholic?"
"Yes, sir."
"And do you not think it strange that the Catholic Church supports this war?"
"I don't know about the Catholic Church, sir, but I can tell you that our government does not support this war. Mr. de Valera has declared Ireland to be neutral."
"Mary, we must put an end to the hypocrisy of a church that says, 'Thou shalt not kill,' the first of our commandments, and yet supports the killing of thousands in this mad warfare."
His face lit up as though he'd had a grand idea, and the way he leaned towards me, I thought he was going to say something wonderful.
"Come to church with me this morning and speak out, will you?"
I can't, sir. It's not right for the likes of me to...
"But Mary, you're the salt of the earth. If all your kind were to rise up..."
"But you don't understand, sir, what it is to be an ordinary person. I do not have the power to speak as you do."
"Perhaps this war is the leveller. You take refuge with my wife and children in the air raid shelter during the bombing, while I cower in my attic room without shelter or protection, and we both know our worst fears."
His foot touched my calf as he swung one leg over the other, and I forgot what he was saying. For a moment I thought it had been intentional, that he had wanted to touch me. But as he ranted on, all his passion held in the brightness of those eyes, I realised that any such thoughts were my own, and I felt closer to Cynthia and her frustration than I did to Christopher Brooke and his political passion. Nevertheless, it was a tender moment we shared in the early morning, warming ourselves over our tea, and I took what I could from it.
"Is your father fighting?"
"No, sir, he has the farm to run."
"Do you have brothers?" I do, sir, and two of the three are enlisted. I did not mention what Brendan was fighting for, his involvement with the IRA. He bowed his head a moment, and then suddenly he thumped the table so that our cups and saucers rattled. You see, I must make myself useful. If only they'd let us serve in a peacekeeping capacity instead of planting potatoes, digging them up, peeling them, eating them. I'm a man in my prime, Mary. As I knew only too well from my observations, I busied myself with the teapot to distract myself from blushing and at such an innocent remark. There is a famous painting by Vincent van Gogh of the potato eaters. Well, we are the potato peelers, me and my kind. He laughed, an empty sound that seemed to echo around us. Before the war, I was a director in my father's hat manufacturing business, but I renounced my directorship. I spent my time on the factory floor, Mary, labouring alongside the common man, working up a sweat instead of dandling a pen.
Then why wouldn't you want to be alongside those men in the war, sir?
I've told you, Mary, I stand for peace.
He spoke with that same patient tone he used with Cynthia and the children.
But, sir, I said, leaning forward, we can't let Hitler march across Europe taking all the land for Germany.
Adolf Hitler has always been in favour of a negotiated peace with Britain, and the British leaders know this. We can only hope for a change of government to rid us of Churchill.
Mr. Churchill seems to know what he's doing, sir.
He's duplicitous, Mary. He is governed by ego and self-interest, and he has made some dreadful mistakes which have affected all Englishmen. I make a study of the newspapers for my daily news broadcast at Camp Peveril, and I tell you that despite his popularity, Churchill is a heartless man. If we'd had Sir Oswald Mosley for Prime Minister, we'd be living in peace now with the rest of Europe.
It was a little tedious to be lectured at, and in truth I felt his words were wasted on me, an audience of one, and a humble one at that. I did not fill my head much with politics, but more with visions of the future. I don't know what came over me, but without thinking, I took hold of his left hand and stretched it out palm upwards. He surrendered his hand and kept on talking, but I hardly heard a word, so powerful was the force of his flesh on mine. He had beautiful hands, large and square, with long fingers for his piano playing. All the music was in those hands, and all his future too, in criss-crossed lines, like railway tracks running along, unstoppable.
What fortune do you see, Mary, in my palm?
I don't remember what I said, but I was duplicitous like Mr. Churchill. Perhaps I told him there was another child in the palm of his hand, but I didn't tell him she'd have a different mother, and I certainly didn't tell him about the ending I saw moving towards the veins of his wrist.
Here we see the additional gap between working and privileged classes in Britain, completely ignored by Christopher, which only adds to the comic gap. Another rather sad scene is an encounter between Christopher and Colonel Robin Tineye Stevens, head of Latchmere House, where Christopher is interrogated over a three-week period. Summed up in Stevens' comment,
"You're not a bad fellow, Christopher. You're just a nobody."
There is a visible arc in Christopher Brooke's disintegration from politically engaged businessman, sportsman, musician, socialite, to ridiculous outcast. The tragedy does not so much affect Christopher. He never gives up on his mistaken beliefs, even as they become grotesque. But it deeply affects his family, and in particular his wife Cynthia. Obviously, Nancy and James Brooke love their son, and his children love him. But Cynthia is impassioned and committed on several levels. She is married to Christopher. She has borne four children to him. She is financially dependent on him and is completely unprepared for any other kind of life. She is in a room with the walls gradually closing in on her. Christopher moves from a pre-war belief in appeasement, a belief in which he has plenty of company. No one in Britain wanted another war after the Great War, in which so many had suffered and died horribly, to a bizarre blend of religion and politics, in which he believes Hitler to be a Christ figure. So enigmatic is Christopher that it is impossible for the reader to determine on what exactly this disintegration turns. As the writer of Mad Hatter, I know little more than the reader,
though I suspect that Captain Thomas St. Barbe Baker played a part and used the writer's license to build on this research-based suspicion. They meet in the internment camp on the Isle of Man, where Baker courts what he accurately perceives to be a broken man, ripe for the ego-massaging attention Baker gives while reaching into Brooke's deep pockets. There is a dramatic irony in the fact that Christopher, during the process of his internment, adopts a stance that represents the very threat to national security for which he was originally arrested and imprisoned. Though, as Stevens accurately perceives, Christopher is indeed a nobody. He no longer has any connections or political power that might serve his ends. He has lost his connection to Mosley and has taken up with fringe people. Hangers-on, swindlers, a pantomime troupe of drinkers and eccentrics, odd strangers sought out as sounding boards for his gospel, like Mary Byrne over morning tea. Christopher obviously had little connection to such people before his internment. When he finally gets out of solitary confinement in Walton Jail, he is overjoyed to be in the company of his fellow men at Ascot Camp and is immediately made leader of his group. He discovers a honky-tonk piano and delights in playing for the men, displaying his musical talent. Again, I use the writer's license to imply that it is only after 3 weeks of incarceration and interrogation at Latchmere House that Christopher appears a broken man. I don't know the decisive moment of his shattering, but it is implied that the encounter with Stevens was the last straw, compounded by the subsequent encounter with Baker, who, like Stevens, is an eccentric and operates outside social guidelines. Mary Byrne accurately discerns that Christopher is, quote, so removed as to be entirely protected from a feeling of hurt. And later she says of his untouchability, distance can be a blessing. When news comes over the radio in the voice of broadcaster Richard Dimbleby about the dreadful discoveries at the Bergen-Belsen camp, Christopher takes refuge in his music. Charlotte reached over and cracked the top of my egg. She removed its head with a teaspoon and showed me how to dip my soldier in the yolk. We sat silently eating our breakfast and watching our mother's face, with Richard Dimbleby's solemn voice in the background. Mum looked pale, with her hand to her mouth and her eyes filling with tears. We were all very frightened. When Daddy came home in the afternoon, there was a terrible fight. We heard her shouting at him outside the scullery by the washing machine, where he had to take off his work clothes. When he'd had a bath and came downstairs, he looked puzzled and didn't seem to hear us when we talked to him. He went to the piano and started playing, bits and pieces from many different tunes, all jumbled up. Christopher's music is another instance of his being, in the words of Mary Byrne, so removed as to be entirely protected from a feeling of hurt. The piano is his refuge, an instrument that allows him to place his entire being inside the music, where no one can reach him or interrupt his well-practiced control over the flow of sound. I did not write Mad Hatter as a defense of my father. Not having known him, I wrote it rather as a quest to discover who he was. I grew up in a house where his name was taboo. Without knowing any details of his life, I felt an instinctive shame in the family name I carried. As a teenager, I went looking for work in Wilmslow, the town where Alan Turing, the World War II codebreaker and computing pioneer, as portrayed in the movie Enigma, had committed suicide in 1954 after being convicted of gross indecency, that is, homosexuality, and chemically castrated by that same government he had served. 59 years later, the British Crown had the gall to grant Turing a posthumous royal pardon. But I digress. Back to Wilmslow and my job hunt. When I was asked to give my name, I became suddenly fearful and blurted out my stepfather's name, a man I disliked intensely. But I wanted a job and had obviously by then internalized the power of that taboo my surname carried. The gutter press had ensured that, at least locally, our family name was tainted. My quest to discover who my father was failed. but I did get to walk in my mother's shoes and gained a deeper understanding of the shame and humiliation she suffered, along with the pain of essentially losing the man she had married. Like many men who go to war and return as strangers to their families, my father came out of his 3 years of internment, able-bodied, but psychologically broken. I should say that these are my speculations regarding my father, or Christopher Brooke, as we call him. There is no way to know what happened. But after years of research and a lifetime of wondering, dreaming, questing, I am emboldened to share these open-ended conclusions to an unsolved mystery. I will close by reading the afterword to Mad Hatter, written in January 2019. This is the only part of the book where I step outside of the characters I have created and speak as myself. Afterword. Mad Hatter is my father's story as imagined by me, based on historical and family research. It took more than 50 years to arrive at the place where I could begin my first tentative attempts to write this book. I had to wait actively for the shame-induced fog to clear, in order to reveal to myself the simple facts of this deeply emotional story. I had to believe those facts as real, and not simply a story I'd grown up with, and then I had to transform them into a story laced with memory and imagination. I had to hone my craft as a writer until I was sufficiently skilled in imagining believably what could not be verified by memory. That is why Mad Hatter is a fiction, not a biography of my father, not a memoir of my own experience of his absence, nor even a tricky creative non-fiction, though elements of those genres do punctuate the story. And this is why, after a lifetime of active waiting, the actual writing took so long. 12 years of exploratory writing and research, followed by 6 years of full-on intentional writing. I had to take hold of my experience, take charge of it, and make it part of my identity, by creating the memories which have been denied me, and which I have hungered for all my life. Key issues have been censorship, taboo, shame and humiliation, silence, secrecy, reclamation of emotional memory through various means, the tipping points being sculpture and writing. Once I had reclaimed the memory of unconditional love for my father, I had to surrender to an overwhelming and debilitating process of grieving his death. The reclamation and the grieving have been the most painful and the most rewarding, because they have given me back my humanity. Thank you for listening. Mad Hatter is available in paperback and as an e-book from Guernica Editions. The audiobook is at audible.ca, where you can hear a 5-minute sample reading. For information on all my books, see my website, amandahale.com. My work is also available through Canadian libraries, from your local indie bookstore, and as a last resort, from the sometimes unavoidable Amazon.